Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. In his second novel, Drew McGarry shares some characteristics with the protagonist. They're both Marylanders by way of Minnesota with a wife and three kids. But in this modern fantasy take on the Odyssey, none of the rules of our dimension apply. What the hike shares with McGarry's first novel, The Postmortal, is a keen eye for action and a deep understanding of human needs, fears, and longing. McGarry, a correspondent for GQ and columnist for Deadspin, has written three other books, but is maybe most proud to be a Chopped champion. Drew McGarry, welcome back to the Roundtable.
Yeah, that would be accurate on the Chopped. that's probably right. That goes on the gravestone.
So I knew you were a football player growing up, but I didn't know if you were a nerd. Did you read a lot of sci-fi and fantasy stuff?
Like I liked a lot of nerd stuff like D&D, and I liked like certain video games like King's Quest and stuff like that. And I think even back then in the 80s, I don't think a lot. I think that there was a lot of popular culture stuff that was nerdy, but people who were just sort of whatever. Like I wasn't really anything. Like I wasn't a jock. I mean, I played football, but I wasn't in with the jocks. And I wasn't like a super, huge nerd like with a round table, Magic the Gathering club or anything like that. I was just sort of nothing, And I think there's a lot of people who are like that, especially now, because essentially nerd culture is pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real strong definition to it, I think, anymore.
Do you have to embrace that more now that you do have a science fiction book out?
I mean, yeah, you want fantasy fanboys to read it. But you also want, it's the challenge with any book. You want everyone to read it, so you just have to go begging on your hands and knees to everybody and be like, oh, please, God, it's really good, I swear, but it's not boring.
What inspired you to write this book?
All right, so it's the first part of the book is all true, except like when monsters start getting involved. I had to go give a talk, and I was in rural Pennsylvania, like 75 miles from town, and it was like in the Poconos, and it was up on a hill. It was a secluded inn. There was nobody there. I was the only guest, right? So already I'm like, what's going on here? And then I go down to the clerk, and I say to her, because I had time, I was like, I'm gonna go take a hike. Is there a path around? She's like, no, I don't think so. And I was like, really? That's kind of weird, because it's the Poconos, right? It's a highly settled area. So then I go behind the hotel, because I was just going to walk anyway, and there's a huge path, like, clearly marked, like, like well-trod. And so then I was like, well, either she just doesn't know what's in her backyard, or maybe this just appeared for me, just for me. And that's where everything got started from.
You've written about the time you enjoy getting away from your family, but I think it's fair to say that you do miss them. But do you spend a lot of time in hotel rooms, and how do you cope with that?
I mean, lately I have, because I had to do the RNC, and I had to do Comic-Con, and I had to do this book tour. I think I'm sort of over it. Like, a lot of the anxiety in the book is stuff that I have lately resolved, because my kids are older, and they're a lot more manageable. So I really, really, it's not a struggle to take care of them. Like, I've been a parent for 10 years now, so I sort of have the gist of it. Like, I'll never be perfect at it, but there's a lot less angst than there used to be. So when I go now, I really don't like getting away from them. Like, I really don't want to travel away from them anymore.
This is your second novel, and, you got your start sort of writing about sports on the internet. Did you ever worry that you wouldn't be taken seriously as a novelist?
No, I actually didn't worry about that. I think the biggest worry for me is, okay, well, I've written something, I have an audience that, is not the target for this sort of thing. And I have to go target an audience who doesn't really know who I am, or doesn't care, or maybe doesn't like the sports stuff that I do, doesn't care at all about sports, doesn't even know, like, what NFL teams are which. And that's the bigger problem. It's not critical acceptance, it's not respect. I don't really care about any of that, because I really just want people to read it and like it. And it doesn't matter who's reading it and who likes it. I don't care about wars. I don't care about any fart sniffer stuff like that. But that's the challenge, is really just getting people who might not want to read you doing that, doing it.
I have a question about one of the plot points in the book. You have a weekly column on Deadspin, the fun bag, which always has crazy hypotheticals, people emailing in questions, would you rathers and things. And your protagonist, Ben, at one point has to choose between fighting one full-sized man and five dwarves. And that, to me, sounded like it was right out of the mailbag.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought of the question. I swear I didn't nick it from memory. But I had that, you know, I had that once with Postmortal. When Postmortal came out, someone said, oh, it's like Drew just answered a fun bag question for 300 pages. And I was like, actually, that's kind of right. And like that, I like that sort of approach to writing a novel. That seems like a good idea. Just take an idea that's rich enough to expound on, take a hypothetical, and then just make a book out of it.
In the Postmortal, there's a chance to live forever. And I know you've thought about that question before. The novel really doesn't end well, as humans don't die. But, you know, what do you think about that question now, having written the book?
You know, the book is very pessimistic. Like, I've had people ding me for that. And that was just where the idea went, you know? It wasn't necessarily my personal philosophy. Like, there's a lot of bad stuff, I think, in the world, but I think there's a lot of good stuff, too. And I think that the world is very much redeemable. And, you know, I'm fearful about what's coming next, but I'm also enjoying the time I have, you know? But I'm not the type to sit around and say, well, we're all screwed and nothing matters. Like, that's just not how I work philosophically, but the idea of the book was the irony of people living forever and ending up killing each other as a result.
At the risk of editorializing, let me segue to the Republican National Convention that you covered recently. Was that your first time at a convention?
It was my first time at a convention, and everyone was like, they aren't normally like this.
What was your approach? Because I know, you know, you've done a lot of pieces that are empathetic to people you probably don't agree with. But what was your approach going in?
I mean, it's the same thing. I always sit down with our editor. We always have the same approach, which is nobody wants us to go there just to sneer and just to, like, point at the stupid people and go, oh, look at all the stupid people. That's stupid, you know? And that's really just... That's the sort of uppity media attitude that has gotten us into this mess, right? So, you know, it's always, okay, have an open mind, be respectful, listen to people. But if it ends up being damning, that's fine, but you always want to be fair. And frankly, you know, like, I have a lot of affinity for, like, redneck lifestyles. Like, I like jet skis, I like drinking beer, I like walking around with that shirt on in a July afternoon, like... There's a lot of common ground there.
So did you get the sense at the convention that a lot of people inside the Republican Party, inside the convention, were also surprised to be in this situation?
I think that I don't think they were surprised, because there was the surprise phase was over. This was, especially on the first night, it was very, very tepid, especially the roll call and stuff like that, because you didn't, you know, it was impossible to hide the fact that they weren't all united behind Donald Trump. So, you know, when the delegates were in there, a lot of them were there for Ted Cruz and liked him and stuff like that. And so, you know, there were vocal Trump fans, but there was also it was really mixed. It was like just sort of like people who didn't care for Trump. They didn't boo, but they sat on their hands. And then by, you know, Thursday night when he accepted the nomination, well, those delegates were gone. Like they were just going to go drink and drown their sorrows, and all we're left were a handful of Trump fanboys. But it wasn't a scene. Like, it was just not. You could tell there was a palpable lack of enthusiasm.
What about on the sports side? One of your most famous posts of all time was about LeBron James, and I won't say the title, but people can Google it if they want.
I can't say it anymore either.
But he came back to town in Cleveland, where the RNC was, and made it a title town right before he got there, right?
Yeah, man, I was way wrong about LeBron. LeBron's the GOAT, man. I'm wrong. I mean, you know, when we make fun of a lot of hot takers and stuff like that at Deadspin, I think the number one thing is there's an odd contagion among media people, presidential candidates, political, you know, opiners and stuff, where you never admit you're wrong, you know? And I think the real difference, you know, I think the only thing I can take home that makes me different from, like, a Skip Bayless is saying, yeah, nah, I got that wrong. I was wrong.
What do you think the future of Deadspin is? Of course, Gawker has been in this crazy court case involving the Hulk Hogan sex tape and Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley billionaire who funded the lawsuit. And I just read this week that Nick Denton, the president of the company, had to declare personal bankruptcy. I mean, are you worried about your guys' space on the internet right now?
No, I've been told to keep calm and carry on. And, you know, I mean, Gawker has always had some sort of turmoil going on around it forever, you know? Like, there's always been something. There's always been something a bit dramatic going on. But, you know, I'm of the mind that, you know, there's no point in us panicking or anything like that because I don't have any control over the situation. All I can do is sort of bear down and write all the dopey NFL previews I can. And I think... because they have control over who's going to have some control over who's going to buy the company, I think it will end up in good hands. But you know, you never know what the future's going to hold. But I think it's going to be fine.
Let's go to the NFL. You're a huge football fan, but you've also written a lot about your problems with the league. You know, namely the commissioner and CTE for two. Is there any part of you that starts to think about not watching football anymore?
No. I mean, I think the only time I really do it is when the product is bad, you know, when there's too many commercials or when the games are really sloppy and the rules aren't clear because the NFL hasn't had the stones to sort of clarify them or they're changing them on the fly. And that affects the on-field product. So really, I still approach it less from a moral standpoint and more from a bloodless consumer standpoint of whether or not I'm being entertained. And when football rises to the occasion, it's really good, you know? Like, when Aaron Rodgers throws two Hail Marys to tie a game against Arizona, I'm still going to be drawn in. I'm not gonna skip that.
You think the Vikings will be, back to where they were last year?
I think they will, and that means that they're all going to die. That means that something terrible will happen.
I mean, the last time they made the playoffs, it wasn't a pretty end for you.
No, it was pretty horrible. Thanks for bringing it up, though. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I think when that game ended, you just tweeted, "I'm dead," if memory serves.
Yeah. I was. I lay down on the floor like a dead person for good 10, 15 minutes.
You're really known for your haters' guides, and has age mellowed your hating at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think in general, in real life, I'm a pretty happy guy, so... You know, there's a sort of, and probably because I can be cathartic online and get all my frustration out. But I think it's like a roast. I think the reason that it plays is that people see that there's some kernel of irritation that's been sort of blown up to a comical degree in it. But it's still the person writing it is not malicious or a terrible person. Although maybe I.
Do you think The Hike could be a film?
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. I hope they pay me $1 billion and make a movie about it and it wins 50 Academy Awards. I can't wait.
Who did you picture as Ben, if you don't mind showing your cards a little bit?
You know what? I did. It was weird because there were certain answers I thought about for other stuff. Like there's a giant who I thought Catherine Hahn would be really good as. But the main guy I couldn't really peg it. I was like, just anybody good. I'd be happy with anybody good.
What are you working on next, Drew?
Nothing. I haven't started another book. I sort of did, but there's nothing right now. I think right now I sort of have to have a cool down period, and then once an idea pops up, then I sort of go tracing it. I don't force it anymore.
Well, we've been speaking with Drew McGarry, and he's the author of the new novel, The Hike, his second. He also writes for GQ and Deadspin. And Drew, I'm a big fan of yours, and I'm glad we get to have these chats every couple of years. So thanks so much for doing the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. I really appreciate it.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.